This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, a nearly months-long armed takeover of a national wildlife refuge winds down. One militant leader is dead, 11 others in custody. President Obama issues new rules slashing solitary confinement in federal prisons, and the Supreme Court gives juveniles sentenced to life hope for release. And this week marked International Holocaust Remembrance Day, we go to Warsaw and Israel. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. A nearly month-long takeover of a wildlife refuge in Oregon appears to be coming to an end, with just four people remaining at the site Friday morning, 11 of the group's members now in federal custody, and one of their leaders dead. Jenka Soderberg has more from Portland.
After Tuesday night's arrest of Ammon Bundy, the self-proclaimed leader of the takeover, and the fatal shooting of another member of the group by police, most of the people who had set up camp in the Malheur Wildlife Refuge since January 2nd began to move out. The FBI released video late Thursday of the traffic stop that led to the fatal shooting of Lavoy Finicum earlier in the week. Officers say they thought Finicum was about to pull a gun out of his jacket, and while he does appear to be reaching into his jacket in the video, he had no gun in his hand when he was shot. The stated aim of the armed militants was to seize control of public land like the wildlife refuge and turn it over to private landowners. But though some in the community had in the past criticized federal land management, very few participated in the takeover. In fact, many local residents protested the arrival of the militants, including members of the Burns Paiute tribe, like Jarvis Kennedy.
What would they do if I went into their cemeteries where their grandparents are buried and sitting there occupied and driving heavy equipment around over their graves? You know, I could always go out and loot their cemetery, but I have more respect than that.
There you go.
So does my people.
During the last several weeks, the small town of Burns, Oregon, has been besieged by the small group of mainly out-of-state militants who took over the wildlife refuge and began setting up a self-styled base for what they call an anti-government revolution. Jenka Soderberg, FSRN, Portland.
President Barack Obama announced some major policy changes this week that could bring more humanity to the criminal justice system. Tanya Snyder has more.
There is a certain psychosis that is particular to prisoners held in solitary confinement. They often suffer from hallucinations, obsessions, paranoia, panic attacks, and more. Many U.S. prisoners spend years, even decades, alone in a tiny cell with no human contact. Last summer, President Obama told an audience at the NAACP conference that he had ordered his attorney general to look into the practice and recommend changes.
Do we really think it makes sense to lock so many people alone in tiny cells for 23 hours a day for months, sometimes for years at a time? That is not going to make us safer. That's not going to make us stronger. And if those individuals are ultimately released, how are they ever going to adapt?
Obama announced Monday evening in a Washington Post op-ed that he's severely limiting the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons. People with mental illness should get treatment, not solitary confinement, according to the new rules. Those who have committed only minor infractions should not be placed in solitary. And there are severe new limits on how long any inmate should be held in solitary, cutting allowable stints in so-called restrictive housing by more than 80%. Though very few juveniles serve time in federal prisons, there is a new categorical ban on the use of solitary confinement for them. The new rules will affect the approximately 10,000 people currently in solitary confinement in federal prisons. And the president called for state and local correctional complexes to model policies on the new federal regulations. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, Washington.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court also took action that could bring relief and even freedom to thousands of people sentenced as juveniles to spend the rest of their lives behind bars. In 2012, the court ruled in Miller v. Alabama that sentencing adolescents to life without parole is unconstitutional. This week's decision in Montgomery v. Louisiana applies Miller retroactively to juvenile lifers nationwide. According to the Environmental Justice Initiative, nearly 3,000 people in U.S. prisons were sentenced as juveniles to life without parole. One of them is Kerry Shakabuna Marshall. He's among about 500 juvenile lifers serving their sentences in Pennsylvania prisons.
Pennsylvania, they really don't want to carry out the spirit of the Miller decision and let the child offenders who are serving life without parole imprisonment to be released into society. Some of the children who have went down to court to be resentenced under Miller have already received life without parole sentences all over again. They want child lifers to die in prison. Even though the Supreme Court has just ruled that Miller must be retroactively applied to child lifers, Pennsylvania courts is going to try to stonewall that. So we're going to need people in society to really put the pressure on Pennsylvania court system to make sure that the children who have been sentenced to life without parole get the opportunity to actually return to society again.
Marshall was 17 when convicted in the 1988 shooting death of Philadelphia fish vendor Suzette Richardson. He's now an editor of the magazine The Movement, is on the advisory board of the Real Costs of Prisons Project, and is a contributor to Prison Radio. After more than 25 years in prison, Shakabuna Marshall will now be eligible for case review and possible parole. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court also declined to consider reviving what would have been the most restrictive abortion law in the country, North Dakota's so-called fetal heartbeat law. The law would have banned abortion so early in gestation that many women would not even have known they were pregnant yet. But that didn't stop Florida lawmakers from advancing an even stricter measure this week. And as FSRN's Sean Canaan reports, it's just one of several abortion-related bills state legislators are considering, including measures which look a lot like a Texas law currently on the Supreme Court's docket.
The most far-reaching bill before Florida's Republican-dominated state legislature would ban almost all abortions. It's sponsored by Republican Representative Charles Van Zandt and passed the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee this week on a vote of 8-3.
The bill recognizes that both the mother and the baby are citizens of Florida. Both their both their God-given right to each have their lives is and has been a recognized fundamental right as early as the Declaration of Independence.
It's not the first time Van Zandt has brought forth an anti-abortion bill that's of questionable legal standing. Pro-choice groups are pushing back. Laura Goodhue is executive director of the Florida Alliance of Planned Parenthood Affiliates.
And it's really clear just from the way that the bill is written that it is a challenge to the constitutionality of safe and legal abortion. And so, I do believe it's grandstanding. I think it's unfortunate that the legislators are spending time on this because it's political interference at its worst.
And that grandstanding could be expensive for Florida. If this bill becomes law, it will almost certainly be challenged, perhaps all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided this week not to hear a challenge by North Dakota to revive its abortion law that had been struck down because it outlawed abortions after a heartbeat was detected. But Florida's bill goes even further, the moment of conception. In its 1992 Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutional right to have an abortion. Adam Levine is an adjunct professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Florida. He also used to be an OBGYN doctor.
If they're just doing it for politics to show their constituents that they're working hard to eliminate abortion and they're going to drop it, okay, it's a small waste of everyone's time and effort. But if they're doing this specifically to get a challenge up against Casey and Planned Parenthood, against Roe versus Wade, if that's what the plan is, if they want to entice the Supreme Court into a discussion, then that's going to require a lot of money. And I think it's disingenuous of these representatives and senators to pick this fight without putting in the budget how much money they're going to need to spend to do this fight.
43 years ago, Roe versus Wade determined that access to safe legal abortions was a constitutional right under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Van Zandt's bill to ban abortions outright is the most drastic of the bills in the Florida legislature designed to restrict access to abortion, but it's not the only one. One bill would mandate special licensing requirements for clinics that perform abortions. Another would require doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges in a nearby hospital. The provisions are very similar to a Texas law known as HB 2, which is to be argued before the Supreme Court in March. The vice president of a Florida chapter of the National Organization for Women says plans to further regulate abortion clinics would disproportionately limit access for low-income women. Linda Darin is with Pinellas Now.
In this state, Medicaid does not cover abortions. So poor women that have children are covered under Medicaid, but they can't get an abortion paid for by Medicaid. So their only option is to go to abortion clinics, basically. And when we continue to put in rules there that make it harder, like Texas, Florida's trying to put in the rule that they just put in Texas on abortion clinics, over half their clinics closed because they couldn't meet these requirements.
Another bill before the Florida legislature aims to prevent Planned Parenthood from receiving government funds for services covered by Medicaid. Federal and state-level attempts to defund Planned Parenthood intensified after a group known as the Center for Medical Progress released heavily edited sting videos targeting the organization. Two people associated with the Center for Medical Progress were indicted this week by a grand jury in Harris County, Texas, on charges related to the videos. Florida's many abortion-related bills still have committee stops to clear before they can be voted on by the full House or Senate. Sean Canaan, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Florida.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you could support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. Demonstrations against the Trans-Pacific Partnership are growing as leaders of 12 Pacific Rim nations, including the United States, are poised to sign the deal next week. Once signed, the agreement must then be ratified by all 12 to take effect. Joshua Tucker brings us more from Santiago, Chile.
As the 12 TPP member nations make plans to sign the trade agreement at a ceremony next week in New Zealand, protesters marched in 11 cities spanning the length of Chile over the weekend. The massive trade deal was hammered out during 5 years of secret negotiations and will tie together 40% of the world's economy. Supporters of the deal tout its protections for intellectual property rights, its reduction of trade tariffs, and its provisions providing legal recourse for companies who find their profits threatened by the laws of member nations. Opponents of the TPP say it's a threat to jobs and wages, safe food, and affordable medicine. They also caution that the dispute settlement system in the deal give corporations and investors an end run around the sovereign right of nations to govern their own affairs. Claudio Escobar Cáceres, a math professor, spoke as the march began.
What's going to happen is that on February 4th, the president will sign this treaty with all the other member nations, and Congress will ratify in March. Once the president signs, it's taken as is. Congress can't change any of its contents in terms of anything, be it food sovereignty, territorial sovereignty, intellectual property rights, protection for seeds.
Legislators and the public got their first glimpse of the thousands of pages that make up the trade agreement in disclosures made by WikiLeaks. The full text was not officially made public until early November. Last summer, lawmakers in the U.S. granted President Obama fast-track authority on the deal. But if the intense debate on that issue is any indication, an up or down congressional vote on the final agreement could be contentious. The trade agreement must be ratified by the Congress of each of the 12 member nations to take effect. Meanwhile, protests are spreading in other countries, including Malaysia and Peru, two of the poorest countries included in the trade agreement. Here in Chile, anti-TPP protesters say they will march again on February 4th, the day leaders plan to sign the trade agreement. And they vow to continue their protests in March, when the Chilean Congress is set to vote on ratifying the trade agreement. Joshua Tucker, FSRN, Santiago.
In India, six hunger strikers are hospitalized, and protests are growing across the country after a Dalit graduate student committed suicide in the southern city of Hyderabad. FSRN's Jasvinder Sagal reports.
Students at Hyderabad Central University are demanding action after a doctoral student committed suicide last week. Rohit Vemula was a member of the Dalits, the lowest caste in the Hindu social hierarchy, also referred to as the Untouchables. In the summer of 2015, simmering tensions erupted into a campus clash between a pro-Dalit student group and another aligned with the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP. Vemula was among the Dalits. Following the incident, the university took a series of action against the pro-Dalit group, ultimately expelling the 26-year-old PhD candidate and banning him from the campus. Dr. Ruthma Norma, who received the 2006 Right Livelihood Award, is widely known in India for her work in lower caste activism.
This incident against Rohit is an incident is really showing what is the nature of atrocities that is going on in a caste-based and caste-ridden society like India. And he's one of the brightest scholars. And, you know, I think the system really didn't want him to be there. They just finished him off.
Protesters like 25-year-old student Jayalalitha say BJP-aligned members of parliament representing the region pressured university officials to unfairly punish the pro-Dalits. They warned their vice-chancellor and two cabinet ministers to resign their posts.
This is student struggle for emancipation and social justice. We believe in leftist principles. Okay, you come and you extend your solidarity. Okay, you raise, if you also uphold these principles, then you raise this in parliament, you ensure the justice of the murder of Rohit Vemula.
After an initial silence, India's Prime Minister, the BJP's Narendra Modi, finally expressed sorrow at the suicide. Protesters around the country say the issue is inherently political in India, a country still largely structured in distinct social layers with almost 180 million people in the lower castes. A group of Dalit faculty have also joined the protests and announced a hunger strike, and students across the country plan to mark Rohit's 27th birthday on January 30th by marching to New Delhi. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, Hyderabad, India.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. As the refugee crisis continues unabated across Europe, Sweden and Finland announced this week that between the two countries, they expect to reject at least 100,000 asylum seekers and deport them in a process that could take several years. And in Denmark this week, lawmakers approved new laws allowing the government to seize migrants' valuables, reportedly to offset the host country's expenses. Tom Carstensen reports from Copenhagen.
Problemet er med den her lede debat.
Det er ikke nogen nem beslutning, for det er hårde opstramninger.
At den splitter familier.
The Danish parliament passed controversial measures regarding the rights of asylum seekers after a heated three-hour debate Tuesday.
Lovforslaget er
votes were 81 in favor and 27 against, largely along ideological party lines. The bill gained international attention for one provision in particular, the ability to seize valuables from asylum seekers, ostensibly to help the government fund the cost of hosting them in Denmark. But within Denmark, these measures are more seen as a deterrent to get asylum seekers to go elsewhere. Under the new law, asylum seekers can be forced to hand over valuables exceeding $1,400 in worth. The government has clarified that this does not include wedding rings and other objects of sentimental value. Government spokesperson Jakob Ellemann-Jensen denied that Denmark would strip people of their jewelry, even though it's legal in the bill. Another big issue is family reunification. Under the new rules, it can take some asylum seekers up to 3 years before they can get their families to Denmark. The bill's opponents in Parliament worry that the new measures will tarnish Denmark's reputation. MP Johannes Schmidt-Nielsen of the leftist Enhedslisten Alliance spoke to the Danish Broadcasting Corporation on Tuesday. I think Denmark will get tried and convicted for breaching the European Convention on Human Rights, said the staunch opponent of the bill. The debate in Denmark has been very emotional, with opponents of the bill comparing it to Nazi Germany's methods of stripping Jews of their valuables during the Holocaust. This comparison has angered supporters of the bill, who argue that Denmark still provides more safety and financial help to the asylum seekers than many other countries. Supporters also argue that Danes seeking government assistance face similar measures. Danish welfare applicants cannot receive benefits if one has more than $1,400 in the bank or owns excessive valuables. Tom Carstensen, FSRN, Copenhagen.
Wednesday marked International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The date coincides with the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau extermination camp. The Holocaust refers to the systematic mass murder of more than 6 million Jews by the Nazi regime and its collaborators during the Second World War. In total, 11 million people were murdered, including ethnic Poles, Gypsies, Soviet POWs, communists, political opponents to Nazism, homosexuals, and the physically and mentally disabled. FSRN's Philip Warwick has more from Warsaw.
It's winter and snow covers the ground at the largest physical memorial to the Holocaust, the former Auschwitz-Birkenau extermination camp. Of the 1.1 million people murdered here, 900,000 were Jews. Prior to World War II, Poland was home to the largest Jewish community in Europe, with a population of more than 3 million. 6 decades later, estimates put Poland's Jewish population at between 7 and 25,000. Paweł Sawicki, press officer at the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial, says it's hard to convey just how deeply the Holocaust changed Poland socially, culturally and politically.
We talk about great people of Polish culture. Without Polish Jews, Polish culture wouldn't look the same.
As early as the 12th century, religious tolerance in Poland set the country apart from many other European kingdoms during the Middle Ages and fostered the rise of the well-established major Jewish population centre. The Holocaust destroyed 90% of Poland's Jewish population, and many of the traumatized survivors chose to emigrate to build new lives elsewhere. Michael Szudrycz is the chief rabbi of Poland. He says those survivors who remained in the country and their descendants have also had to contend with secondary social impacts on their communities, from Soviet occupation to gentrification-fueled displacement.
And it's not only Auschwitz. Look at Kazimierz, the all-Jewish area of Krakow. I remember it was completely desolate, falling down. It was dangerous 30 years ago to go to Kazimierz, not because of anti-Semitism, because of the drunk and the drug addicts who are hanging out there and all the deserted buildings. Today, you can't afford to rent an apartment.
Krakow is located 150 miles south of Warsaw. From the 15th century on, the city's historical district of Kazimierz was a major Jewish cultural and religious center. Krakow resident Professor Jonathan Weber is a social anthropologist and a former member of the International Council of the Auschwitz Museum. He says the loss of the deeply rooted Jewish population left an immediate vacuum in Polish society, though it wasn't recognized as such during the Soviet occupation.
So when you have a genocide that takes out this population, literally removes it, you've got empty properties, you've got synagogues not being used, you've got cemeteries which are no longer functioning, and you've got a huge economic hole and a gap. And you've then got to educate your young people as to where this all came from and why it happened and how did it happen, etc. And under communism, Soviet communism, which is dominant ideology here, the Soviets didn't want to emphasize the Holocaust as a specifically Jewish phenomenon at all. I mean, so that this was a fascist occupation run by a country which was fundamentally imperialist, that was annexing Polish territory to itself.
Between 1948 and 1950, more than 100,000 Polish Jews immigrated to the newly declared State of Israel. Dr. Michael Kagan is an inventor and author who lives in Jerusalem. He is the son of a Holocaust survivor and is uncomfortable with how his father's experience is used by current Israeli political leaders.
Within society here, there is a very strong tension. You can see that in our political leaders, that they use the Holocaust to create anger, to create shame, that we as a people didn't rise up and fight against it. Guilt, maybe. Maybe there's collective guilt there as well. But trauma, collective trauma. How do you deal with trauma? And so a lot of the right-wing politics here is born from that sense of victim and not being able to cope with it.
The memory and trauma of the Holocaust and how it is employed is an extremely sensitive subject in Israel, including among the ranks of the country's politicians. 30-year-old Staff Shafir is Israel's youngest female member of parliament, known as the Knesset.
Well, sadly, only a few months ago, our prime minister tried to change the memory of the Holocaust by giving it a different, newly discovered, as he may say, angle to the source and relation to the Israeli or the Jewish-Arab relations, and made a very cynical usage of the Holocaust memory. And I think this is shameful, and it's something that should never be done. It's part of that new narrative building, and the right wing in Israel is doing all the time, changing historical narratives to fit their political agenda.
Shafir is concerned about revisionist history after Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu publicly accused the former Palestinian Grand Mufti of Jerusalem of convincing Adolf Hitler to exterminate Europe's Jewish population. Netanyahu's statements, made last October at a conference at the World Zionist Organization, sparked international controversy and prompted the office of the German Chancellor to remind the world that the Nazis were in fact responsible for the Holocaust. Back at Auschwitz, that's a lesson that is made clear to millions of people who visit the memorial each year. Few people who experienced the Holocaust firsthand, survivors, perpetrators, or observers, are still alive to share their stories. It's now up to their descendants and memorials like the one at Auschwitz to make sure subsequent generations never forget. Philip Warwick, FSRN, Warsaw.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to support our work, find downloadable audio and podcast information, and transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Sam Film. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.